The Intrepid Ibis still lay at the old city wharf. Jock McCrump and Ryder Courtney were checking the row of Martini Henry rifles in the gun rack at the back of the open bridge, making certain they were loaded, and that spare packets of the big Boxer Henry .45 caliber cartridges were to hand, should they run into the Dervish blockade when they left the harbour. No sooner had they completed their final preparations than the first of the most important passengers came up the gangplank, Bakshit leading them to their quarters. The Ibis had only four cabins. One belonged to Ryder Courtney, but over Bakshit's protests he was going to relinquish it to the Benbrook family. There were only two bunks in the tiny cabin. They would be crowded, but at least it had its own bathroom. The girls would be afforded some privacy in the crowded steamer. Presumably one of the twins could sleep with her father, while the other would be with Rebecca. The foreign consuls had been allocated the remaining cabins, while the rest of the almost 400 passengers must take their chances on the open decks, or crowded into the three empty barges. The fourth barge was laden with the cordwood, so that it would not be forced to go ashore to cut supplies of this precious commodity. Ryder looked towards the eastern horizon. The moon was only a few days from full, and would give him just enough light to descry the channel down towards the Shabluka Gorge. Unfortunately, it would also light up the target for the Dervish gunners. Their aim was improving each day, as they had more practice and experience with the laying of the Krupp's guns that they had captured at El Obeid. They seemed to possess an endless supply of ammunition. Ryder looked back at the wharf and felt a prickle of irritation. Major Al-Farouk of General Gordon's staff had lined up a company of his troops to guard the perimeter of the harbour. With fixed bayonets, they were prepared to prevent a mob of refugees, without General Gordon's pass, trying to storm the little steamer and force themselves aboard. The desperate populace would go to any lengths and take any chance to escape the city. What annoyed Ryder was that Al-Farouk had allowed his men to light torches so that they could examine the faces and papers of those would-be passengers who were lining up at the entrance. The torchlight now illuminated the entire expanse of the wharf to the scrutiny of the Dervish sentries across the river. "In God's name, Major, get your men to douse those lights," Ryder bellowed. "I have General Gordon's strict orders to allow no one to pass until I have checked their papers." "You are calling the Mahdi's attention to our preparations to sail," Ryder shouted back.
"I have my orders, Captain."
While they argued, the crowd of passengers and hopefuls was swelling rapidly. Most were carrying infants or bundles of their possessions. However, they were becoming anxious and panicky at being forbidden entry. Many were shouting and waving passes over their heads. Those who had no pass stood stubborn and grim-faced, watching for their opportunity.
"Let those passengers through!" Ryder shouted.
"Not until I have examined their passes," the Major retorted, and turned his back, leaving Ryder fuming helplessly at his bridge rail. Al-Farouk was stubborn, and the altercation was having no effect except to delay the embarkation interminably. Then Ryder noticed David's tall figure pushing through the throng, with his daughters pressing close behind him. With relief he saw that Al-Farouk had recognized them and was waving them through the cordon of his troops. They hurried to the gangplank, burdened with their most valued possessions. Saffron was lugging her paintbox, and Amber a canvas bag stuffed with her favourite books. Nazira pushed the girls up the gangplank, for David had used all his influence and the dignity of his office to obtain a pass for her too.
"Good evening, David. You and your family will have my cabin," Ryder greeted him as he stepped aboard.
"Oh, no, no, my dear fellow, we cannot evict you from your home."
"I will be fully occupied on the bridge during the voyage," Ryder assured him. "Good evening, Miss Benbrook. There are only two narrow bunks. You will be a little crowded, I'm afraid, but it's the best available. Your maid must take her place in one of the barges."
"Good evening, Mr. Courtney. Nazira is one of us. She can share a bunk with Amber. Saffron can share with my father. I will sleep on the cabin floor. I am sure we'll all be very comfortable," Rebecca announced with finality.
Before Ryder could protest, an ominous chanting and shouting came from the large crowd held back by the guards at the head of the wharf, like floodwaters by a frail dam wall. It provided him with a welcome excuse to avoid another confrontation with Rebecca. There was an ominous glitter in her dark eyes and a mutinous lift to her chin. "Excuse me, David. I will have to leave you to install yourselves. I am needed elsewhere."
Ryder left them and ran down the gangplank. When he reached Major Al-Farouk's side, he saw that the crowd beyond the line of soldiers was growing larger and more unruly with every minute that passed, and they were pressing right up to the points of the bayonets. Monsieur Leblanc was the last of the diplomatic corps to arrive. Incongruously, he was decked out in a flowing opera cloak and a Tyrolean hat with a bunch of feathers in the band. He was followed by a procession of his servants, each heavily laden with his luggage. Borne aloft on the shoulders of his porters was a pair of brass-bound cabin trunks, each the size of a pharaoh's sarcophagus. "You cannot bring all that rubbish on board, monsieur," Ryder told him, as the guards allowed him to pass. Leblanc reached him with sweat dripping off his chin, fanning himself with a pair of yellow gloves.
"That rubbish, monsieur, as you call it, is my entire wardrobe of clothing and is irreplaceable. I cannot leave without it."
Ryder saw at once the futility of arguing with him. He stepped past Leblanc and confronted the first party of trunk-bearers as they staggered through the cordon with their load. "Put those down," he ordered in Arabic. They stopped and stared at him.
"Do not listen to him," squealed Leblanc, and rushed back to slap at their faces with his glove. "Bring it along, mon brave."
The porters started forward again, but Ryder measured the huge Arab, who was clearly the head porter, then stepped up to him and slapped a punch into the point of his jaw. The porter dropped as though shot through the head. The trunk slipped from his fellows and crashed to the stone flags. The lid flew open, and a small avalanche of clothing and toiletries poured out onto the wharf. The rest of the porters waited for no more, but dropped their load and fled from the wrath of the mad Ferengi captain.
"Now see what you have done,"
cried Leblanc, and fell to his knees. He began gathering up armfuls of his scattered possessions and trying to stuff them back into the trunk. Behind him, the crowd sensed an opportunity. They pressed forward more eagerly, and the guards were forced back a few paces. Ryder grabbed Leblanc's arm and hauled him to his feet. "Come along, you Belgian imbecile!" He tried to drag him towards the gangplank.
"If I am an imbecile, then you are an English barbarian," howled Leblanc.
He reached back and grabbed a trunk's heavy brass handle. Ryder could not break his grip, although he hauled with all his strength. From the back of the crowd, a large rock was hurled at the head of Major Al-Farouk. It missed its target and struck Leblanc's cheek. He shrieked with pain, released the trunk handle, and clutched his face with both hands.
"I am wounded! I am gravely injured!"
More stones flew out of the crowd to fall among the soldiers and bounce off the pavement. One struck an Egyptian sergeant who dropped his rifle and went down on one knee, clutching his head. His men fell back, glancing over their shoulders for a line of retreat. The crowd yammered like a pack of hounds and pressed them harder. Someone picked up the sergeant's fallen rifle and aimed it at Major Al-Farouk. The man fired, and a bullet grazed the major's temple. Al-Farouk dropped, stunned. His men broke and ran back, trampling his prostrate form. They had been transformed in an instant from guards to refugees. Ryder picked up Leblanc and ran with him, kicking, screaming, and struggling in his arms like a child in a tantrum. Ryder dumped the Belgian on the deck, then raced onto his bridge.
"Cast off!" he shouted to his crew, just as the first wave of rioters and half the Egyptian askaris scrambled on board.
The decks were already so overcrowded that the crew were shoved from their positions and were unable to reach the mooring lines. More and more rioters raced down the wharf and leapt on board the steamer or scrambled into the barges. Those already on board tried to beat them back, and the decks were buried under a melee of struggling bodies. Saffron popped her head out of the main cabin to watch the excitement. Ryder picked her up and thrust her bodily into her elder sister's arms, then pushing them both into the cabin. "Stay out of the way!" he shouted and slammed the door. Then he snatched the fire axe from its bracket at the head of the companionway. More rioters were coming out of the darkness, unending hordes. Ryder felt the deck of the Ibis heel over under the uneven distribution of weight.
"Jock!" he shouted desperately. "The bastards are going to capsize us! We have to get her off the jetty!"
He and Jock fought their way through the throng. They managed to cut the mooring lines free, but by this time the Ibis was listing dangerously. When Ryder reached his bridge again and opened the throttle, he could feel the enormous drag of the overloaded barges.
He glanced back and saw that the nearest had less than 2 feet of freeboard. He spun the wheel towards the harbour entrance. The Ibis was driven by a Cooper engine, a powerful unit with 3 cylinders. This modern design incorporated an intermediate steam reservoir for compound expansion that allowed much higher boiler pressure than previous models. The Ibis needed all this power to enable her to drag the string of heavily loaded barges up through the fast-flowing waters of the cataracts. Now, under the thrust of the Cooper, she built up speed, and a white wave blossomed under the bows of each barge, faster still, and the water curled over their bows. A chorus of despairing cries rose from the passengers in the barges as they began to flood and settle even lower in the water. Ryder cut back the power and managed to con the Ibis and her tows out through the harbour entrance into the open river, where he would have more space in which to manoeuvre. But the increased turbulence of the surface exacerbated the build-up of the bow waves. Ryder was forced to throttle right back until he barely had steerage way. The ship was picked up by the current and slewed across the channel with her tow lines becoming fouled. The barges ran down on the Ibis. The first of the heavy vessels crashed into her stern, and she shuddered with the shock. "Cut them loose!" LeBlanc screamed, his voice so shrill with terror that it cut through the din. "Cut them loose! Leave them behind! This is all their fault!" The tangle of vessels, still bound together by their tow lines, drifted past the last buildings of the city, then into the broad reach of the combined Niles. Ryder realized he would have to anchor to give himself time to adjust the trim of the barges so that they would tow obediently. He considered turning back to put the stowaway passengers ashore. As they were now, they might flounder in the Shabluka Gorge. Even if they won through, his legitimate passengers would not be able to endure this overcrowding during the heat of the passage through the desert of the Mother of Stones. Ryder gave the orders to break out the heaviest anchor before they were carried beyond the protection of General Gordon's artillery. Suddenly there was a warning cry from Bakshit. "Boats! Coming fast! Dervish boats from the other bank!" Ryder ran to him and saw a flotilla of dozens of small river craft appearing swiftly and silently out of the darkness from the direction of Omdurman. Feluccas, Nuggas, and small dhows. He ran back to the bridge. The 10,000-candle-power lamp was mounted on the bridge combing. He turned its brilliant white beam on the approaching craft. He saw that they were crammed with armed Ansar. The dervish must have been fully aware of their escape plans and had been lying in ambush for the intrepid Ibis. As they closed with the steamer and her tangled string of barges, the Ansar shrieked their terrible praise of God and brandished their broadswords. The long blades glimmered in the light, and the passengers in the barges wailed with terror. "Man the rail!" Ryder shouted to his crew. "Stand by to repel boarders!" His crew understood this drill well. They had practiced it regularly, for the Upper Nile was a dangerous place, and the tribes who lived upon its banks and in its marshes were savage and wild. They struggled to reach their places at the ship's side to meet the enemy, but the passengers were packed shoulder to shoulder, and they found it almost impossible to force their way through. The ruck of human bodies surged forward as they were shoved from behind, and some of those nearest the side were thrown overboard. They screamed and splashed on the surface until they were borne away on the current or sank beneath it. A young wife with her newborn infant strapped to her back went over, and although she paddled desperately to keep her baby's head above the surface, they were sucked back into the intrepid Ibis's propeller. It was fruitless to attempt to rescue any of those in the water. Nor was there time to anchor, for the dervish boats closed in swiftly. As they reached the barges, they hooked onto the sides, and the Ansar warriors tried to clamber aboard. But they were unable to obtain a foothold on the packed decks. They hacked and stabbed at the screaming passengers with their swords, trying to clear a space. The barges rolled wildly. More bodies splashed overboard. The next wave of dervish boats came at the Ibis from her starboard side. Ryder dared not open the throttle of his engines for fear of swamping the leading barge. If that happened, the drag on the tow line would be so powerful the barge might drag Ibis under with her. He could not run from them, so he must fight them off. By this time, Jock McCrump and Bakshit had passed out the Martini Henry rifles from the gun rack. Some of the Egyptian askaris had brought their Remington carbines on board with them and stood shoulder to shoulder with the crew at the rail. Ryder played the spotlight on the approaching boats. In its stark beam, the faces of the Ansar were murderous with battle lust and religious ardour. They seemed as inhuman as a legion from the gates of hell.
"Aim!" shouted Ryder, and they levelled their rifles. "One round volley! Fire!"
The hail of heavy lead slugs ripped into the closely packed Arabs in the feluccas, and Ryder saw one dervish flung backwards into the river, the sword spinning from his hands, and half of his skull blown away in a bright cloud of brains and blood, sparkling crimson in the spotlight beam. Many more were struck down or hurled overboard by the impact of the 450-grain bullets at such close range.
"Load!"
Ryder yelled. The breech blocks snickered metallically, and the spent cases pinged away. The riflemen thrust fresh cartridges into the open breeches and snapped the loading handles closed.
"One round volley! Fire!"
Before the men in the small boats had recovered from the first volley, a second smashed into them, and they sheered away from it. At that moment, Ryder heard David's voice carry above the wails and shrieks of the other passengers.
"Behind you, Mr. Courtney!"
David had climbed up onto the roof of the cabin. He was balanced there with one of his shotguns held at high port across his chest. Ryder saw Rebecca at his side. She held one of her father's Webley revolvers in each hand and handled them in a businesslike manner. Behind them stood the twins, each with a loaded shotgun ready to pass forward to their father. Their faces were moon-pale but determined. The Benbrook family made a heroic little group above the struggling turmoil on the deck. Ryder felt a quick upthrust of admiration for them. David pointed over the opposite rail with the barrel of his shotgun, and Ryder saw that another wave of dervish boats was closing in from that side. He knew he could not get his men back across the crowded deck before the attackers came aboard. If he did, he would leave the starboard side undefended. Before he could make the decision and give the order, David took matters into his own hands. He raised the Purdy shotgun and let fly right and left into the crew of the nearest boat. The spreading cloud of goose shot was, at this range, more potent than the single Boxer Henry bullet. The instant carnage in the felucca stunned the dervish attackers. Four or five had gone down and were struggling on the deck in puddles of their own blood. Others had been knocked over the side, and flotsam washed away on the stream. Saffron slipped the second Purdy into her father's hands, while Amber reloaded the empty gun. Rebecca fired the Webley revolvers into the nearest felucca. The recoil from each shot threw the heavy weapons high above her head, but their effect was deadly. David fired again in such quick succession that the shots seemed to blend together in a single jarring concussion, as this havoc of lead pellets and revolver bullets sprayed over the boats, and they saw the tall white man on the cabin roof raise a third gun and aim at them. Two of the felucca captains put their helms over and turned away, unwilling to accept such punishment.
"Ha, good man!" Ryder laughed. "And well done, you lovely ladies!"
The dervish feluccas gave up on such dangerous, vicious prey and turned on the overladen and defenceless barges. Now that all the attackers were concentrating on them, their fate seemed sealed. Dervish Ansar hacked their way on board, and the passengers were driven like sardines before a barracuda to the far rail of the ungainly craft. The bullock was driven under by their combined weight, and the river rushed in and flooded her. The barge foundered and rolled over. Her weed-carpeted bottom pointed for a moment towards the moon. Then she plunged under and was gone. Immediately the sunken barge acted like a great drogue on the towline, and the intrepid Ibis was cruelly curbed, like a horse pulled onto its haunches. The towline had been made by twisting together three ordinary hawsers. It was immensely powerful, far too strong to part and release the barge. The Ibis's stern was dragged down irresistibly, and the water flooded the afterdeck in a rush. Ryder tossed his rifle to one of the Ibis's stokers and seized the heavy fire axe from him. He sprang down onto the flooding deck and shouldered his way to the stern. He was already knee-deep in water, which cascaded in over the transom. Soon it would flood the engine room and quench the boiler fire. Ryder gathered himself and balanced over the towline, which was now stretched tight as an iron bar through its fair lead in the stern plating. It was as thick as a fat man's calf, and there was no give or elasticity in the water-laid strands. Ryder swung the axe from full reach above his head with all his strength, and with a crack a dozen strands parted at the stroke. He swung the axe high once more and put every ounce of muscle behind his next stroke. Another dozen strands gave way. He kept swinging the axe, grunting with the power behind each stroke. The remaining strands of the cable unravelled and snapped under the fierce drag of the submerged barge and the Ibis's driving propeller. Ryder jumped back just before the rope parted and slashed at him like some monstrous serpent. Had the parting cable end caught him squarely, it might have broken both his legs, but it missed him by a few inches. He felt the Ibis lurch under him as she was freed of the drag, then spring back onto an even keel. She seemed to shake the water off her decks as a spaniel shakes when it comes ashore with a dead duck in its jaws. Then the propeller bit in hard and Ibis surged forward. Saffron was shaken from her perch on the cabin roof. Her arms windmilled and Rebecca tried to catch her, but she slipped through her fingers and fell backwards with a shriek. If she had struck the steel deck, she might have caved in the back of her skull. But Ryder threw aside the axe, dived under her, and snatched her out of the air. For a moment he held her to his chest. "A bird you certainly ain't, Saffy," he grinned at her, and ran with her towards his bridge. Although she tried to cling to him, he dumped her unceremoniously in Nazira's arms. Without a backward glance, he jumped behind the Ibis's wheel and pushed the twin throttles wide open. With a rush of steam from her piston exhausts, she tore away, rejoicing to be free of her towing cable, building up swiftly to her top speed of 12 knots. Ryder brought her round to port in a narrow arc of 180 degrees, until he was rushing straight back towards the tangled mass of barges and feluccas. "What are you going to do?" David asked, as he appeared at Ryder's side with his shotgun over his shoulder. "Pick up the swimmers?" "No," Ryder replied grimly. "I'm going to add to, not subtract from, the number of swimmers." The bows of the Ibis were reinforced with a double thickness of half-inch steel plate to withstand contact with the rocks of the cataracts. "I'm going to ram," he warned David. "Tell the girls that we will hit with an almighty thump, and they must hang on tight." The Dervish boats were thick as vultures round an elephant carcass. Ryder saw that some of the Ansar were freeing the tow lines that held the barges together and passing the cables down to the dhows. Obviously, they intended dragging them one at a time into the shallows of the west bank, where they could complete the slaughter and plundering at their leisure. The rest were still hacking at the cowering bodies on the crowded decks, or leaning over the sides to stab at those who were struggling in the water and screaming for mercy. In the beam of the Ibis's spotlight, the waters of the Nile were stained the colour of mulberry juice by the blood of the dead and dying, and rivulets of blood trickled down the sides of the barges. "Murderous swine!" Rebecca whispered. Then to Nazira, "Take the twins to the cabin. They should not witness this." She knew it was a forlorn command. It would require more bodily strength than Nazira possessed to remove them from the bridge. In the reflection of the spotlight's beam, their eyes were huge with dreadful fascination. The capsized barge was floating bottom up, but sinking swiftly. Suddenly its stern rose, pointed at the moon, then slid below the surface and was gone. Ryder steered for a cluster of three big feluccas, which had tied on to the side of the nearest surviving barge. The Ansar were so busy with their bloody work on the deck that they did not seem to notice the Ibis bearing down on them. At the last moment, one of the dhow captains looked up and realized the danger. He shouted a warning, and some of his comrades were scrambling back into the feluccas as the Ibis struck. Ryder brought her in so skillfully that her steel bows tore through the wooden hulls in quick succession, the timbers shrieking and exploding with the sound of cannon fire as the boats capsized or were driven under the bloody waters. Although the Ibis touched the side of the barge as she tore past, it was a glancing blow, and the vessel spun away. Ryder looked down into the terrified faces of the surviving refugees and heard their piteous entreaties for rescue. He had to harden his heart. The choice before him was to sacrifice all or rescue some. He left them and brought the Ibis round, still under full throttle, then aimed at the next group of Dervish attack boats as they wallowed helplessly without steerage way alongside another drifting barge. Now the Ansar were fully aware of the danger. The Ibis bore down on them, and the blazing cyclops eye of the spotlight dazzled them. Some threw themselves overboard. Few could swim, and their shields and broadswords drew them under swiftly. The Ibis crashed at full throttle into the first felucca, shattered it, and ran on with scarcely a check. Beyond was one of the largest Dervish dhows, almost the length of the Ibis herself. The steamer's steel bows sliced deeply into her, but could not sever her hull. The impact threw her back on her heels, and some of those on her deck were hurled overboard with the crew of the dhow. Ryder threw the Ibis into reverse, and as he backed off from the mortally stricken dhow, he played the spotlight beam around her. Most of the Dervish boats had recovered their boarding parties from the barges, abandoning their prey in the face of the Ibis's ferocious onslaught. They hoisted sail and steered back towards the west bank. The three surviving barges were no longer linked together, for the Ansar had succeeded in freeing the lines. Independently of each other, they were spreading out and drifting in towards the west bank, thrust across the wide bend of the river by the current. In the powerful beam, Ryder could just make out the Dervish hordes waiting to welcome them and complete the massacre. He swung the Ibis round in the hope that he could reach at least one and pick up the towline again in time to drag it off the hostile shore. As he tore towards the barges, he saw that the one that contained the cordwood, heavier than the others, was being carried more slowly on the current. The remaining two were still in its teeth, their decks piled with the dead and wounded, blood painting their sides, glistening red in the spotlight beam. They would soon be into the shallows where the Ibis could not follow them. Ryder knew every shoal and bend of the river as intimately as a lover knows the body of his beloved. He narrowed his eyes and calculated the angles and relative speeds. With a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach, he realized he could not reach them in time to rescue them all. He kept the Ibis tearing downstream under full steam, but he knew it was hopeless. He saw first one barge, then the other check sharply and come to a halt, stranded on the shoals. From the shore, the waiting Dervish warriors plunged into the river and waded out waist-deep to finish the slaughter. Ryder was forced to throttle back and watch helplessly in horror and pity as the Ansar scrambled aboard and their bloody work began again. In vain he directed the rifle fire of his crew at the hordes of Dervish still wading out to the stranded vessels, but the range was long and the bullets had little effect. Then he saw that the cordwood barge was still floating free. If he acted swiftly, he might still be able to salvage it before it too went aground. He opened the throttle and raced down to intercept it. It was of crucial importance to recover the stock of fuel for his boilers. With it they might reach the first cataract without being forced ashore to cut more timber. Ryder shouted to Jock McCrump to prepare a new towline, then brought the Ibis alongside the barge and held her in position while Jock and the boarding party jumped across to fix the fresh line. "Quick as you like, Jock!" Ryder shouted. "We're going to touch bottom at any moment." He looked anxiously at the enemy shore. They had now drifted within pistol shot, and even as he thought it, he saw muzzle flashes as the Dervish riflemen opened fire on them from the bank. A bullet struck the bridge rail and ricocheted so close past David's ear that he ducked instinctively, then straightened, looking embarrassed. He turned sternly to Rebecca. "Get the twins below immediately and make sure they stay there until I tell you." Rebecca knew better than to argue with him when he used that tone. She gathered the twins and drove them off the deck with her fiercest tone and expression. Nazira needed no urging and scuttled down to the cabin ahead of them. Ryder played the spotlight along the bank, hoping to intimidate the Ansar marksmen, or at least to illuminate them so that his own crew could return fire more accurately. Although Jock worked fast to rig the new towline, it seemed like an eternity as they drifted swiftly towards the shallows and the waiting enemy. At last he bellowed across, "All secure, Captain!" Ryder reversed the Ibis slowly until the gap between the two vessels was narrow enough for Jock and his team to leap back on board the steamer. As soon as his feet hit the Ibis's steel deck, he yelled, "Haul away!" With a rush of relief, Ryder eased the throttles ahead and gently drew the barge after him until she was following like an obedient dog on a leash. He began to haul her off into the mainstream of the river when a rushing sound filled the air and something passed so close above him that his hat spun off his head. Then, immediately afterwards, there followed the unmistakable boom of a 6-pounder cannon, the sound following the shell from the west bank. "Ah, they brought up one of their artillery pieces," David remarked in a conversational tone. "Only wonder is that it's taken them so long." Quickly, Ryder doused the spotlight beam. "They could not fire before for fear of hitting their own ships," he said, and his last words were drowned by the next shell howling overhead. That was not so close. He kept his right hand pressing down on the throttle handles to milk the last turn of speed out of his vessel. The weight and drag of the barge cut at least 3 knots off their speed. "They're close enough to be using open sights," David said. "They should be able to do better than that." "They will. Oh, I'm sure they will." Ryder looked up at the moon, hoping to see the shadow of a cloud fall across it. But the sky was brilliant with stars, and the moon lit the surface of the Nile as if it were a stage. For the gunners, the Ibis would stand out against the silver waters like a granite hillock. The next shell fell so close alongside that a shower of river water fell over the bridge and soaked those on it so that their shirts clung to their backs. Then there were more cannon flashes along the shore behind them as the Dervish gunners dragged up gun after gun and unlimbered to bring the Ibis under fire. "Jock, we'll have to give them the best of it and cut the barge loose," Ryder called to the engineer.
"Aye, skipper. I had a notion ye'd say just that."
Jock picked up the axe and started towards the stern. Another Dervish gun carriage galloped along the bank until it was slightly ahead of the straining Ibis and her burden. Though neither Ryder nor David was aware of it, the master gunner commanding the mounted battery was the Ansar, whom David had dubbed the Bedlam Bedouin. From astride the lead horse of the team, he gave a sharp command, and they wheeled the gun carriage into line with the gun's muzzle pointing out across the river and unlimbered. The number 2 and 3 loaders stamped the heavy steel base plate into the soft earth of the riverbank. They set the point of the trail into its slot in the plate. While they worked, the master gunner was shrieking orders, wild with excitement. He had never, in all his brief career, been offered such a fine target as the Ferengi ship now presented. It was almost broadside on. Its silhouette stood out crisply against the shimmering waters. It was so close that he could hear the terrified voices of the passengers raised in prayer and supplication, and the peremptory commands of the captain speaking in the infidel language the gunner could not understand. He used a handspike to traverse the gun round the last few degrees until the long barrel was aiming directly at the ship. Then he wound down the elevation handle until he was gazing over the open iron sights at his target. "In the name of Allah, bring the bomb-bombs!" he screamed at his loaders. They staggered up with the first ammunition box and knocked off the clips that held the lid in place. Inside, 4 shells lay in their wooden cradles, sleek and glistening ominously. The gunner, self-taught in the art of gunnery, had not yet fathomed the arcane principle of fuse delays. In fumbling haste, he used the Allen key he wore around his neck to screw the fuses to the maximum setting, in the belief that this imparted to each missile the greatest amount of destructive power. The Ibis was a mere 300 yards off the bank. He set his fuses at 2,000 yards. "In God's name, let us begin!" he ordered. "In God's name!" His number 2 flung open the breech of the Krupps with a flourish. "In God's name!" intoned the number 3, and slid one of the long shells deep into the chamber until it was snug against the lands. The number 2 slammed the breech block shut. "God is great!" said the Bedlam Bedouin, as he squinted over his sights to make certain of his aim. He traversed the mount 4 degrees left until he was aiming at the base of the Ibis's funnel. Then he jumped back and seized the lanyard. "Allah is mighty," he said. "There is no other god but God. chorused his team. "And Muhammad and the Mahdi are his prophets." The gunner jerked the lanyard, and the Krupp slammed back against its baseplate. The discharge deafened the crew with its report and blinded them with the muzzle flash and the flying dust. On an almost flat trajectory, the shell howled over the river and struck the intrepid Ibis 2 feet above the waterline and just astern of the midships. It passed obliquely through her hull as readily as a stiletto through human flesh, but by virtue of the maximum fuse setting, it did not explode. Had it been 3 inches higher or lower, it would have done minimal damage, nothing that Jock McCrump, with his gas welding equipment, could not have repaired within a few hours. But that was not to be. In passing, it slashed through the main steam line from the boiler. Steam heated to twice the temperature of boiling water and under pressure of almost 300 pounds to the square inch erupted in a shrieking jet from the ruptured pipe. It swept over the nearest stoker as he bent to thrust a faggot of timber into the open firebox of the boiler. He was naked in the heat, except for a turban and a loincloth. Instantly the steam peeled the skin and the flesh off his body in great slabs to expose the bones beneath. The agony was so terrible that the man could not utter a sound. Mouth gaping in a silent scream, he fell writhing to the deck and froze into a sculpture of the utmost agony. Steam filled the engine room and boiled in dense white clouds from the ventilation ports to pour over the decks, shrouding the Ibis in a dense white cloud. Rapidly, the ship lost power and swung idly broadside to the current. The Bedlam Bedouin and his gun crew howled with excitement and triumph as they reloaded. But their quarry was now obscured by her own steam cloud. Although shells from many Krupp's batteries along the bank plunged into the water alongside or ripped the air overhead as though a giant was tearing a canvas mainsail in two, no more struck the little Ibis. Jock McCrump had been on the bridge with Ryder when the shell struck. He grabbed a heavy pair of working gloves from the locker beside the forward steam winch and pulled them on as he ran back to the engine room hatchway. The steam that billowed through the opening stung his face and the bare skin of his arms, but the pressure in the boiler had dropped as the steam bled off through the ruptured pipe. He ripped the heavy canvas curtain that covered the hatch from its rail and snapped at Ryder. "Wrap me, skipper!" Ryder understood instantly what he was going to do. He shook out the thick curtain, then wound Jock in it, cloaking his head and every part of his body but for his arms. "The grease pot!" Jock's voice was muffled by the folds of canvas. Ryder seized it from its hook beside the winch, scooped out handfuls of the thick black grease, and spread it over the exposed skin of Jock's muscular arms. "That'll do," Jock grunted, and opened a slit in his canvas head cover to draw one last deep breath. Then he covered his face and plunged blindly down the steel companion ladder. He held his breath and closed his eyes tightly. But the steam scalded the exposed skin, melting away the coating of black grease from his bare arms. Jock knew every inch of his engine room so intimately that he did not need to see it. Guiding himself with a light touch of gloved fingers over the familiar machinery, he moved swiftly towards the main pressure line. The shrieking of high-pressure steam escaping from the rupture threatened to burst his eardrums. He felt his arms cooking like lobsters in the pot and fought the impulse to scream lest he used the last air in his aching lungs. He stumbled over the stoker's corpse but recovered his balance and found the main steam line. It was wrapped with asbestos rope to prevent heat loss, so he was able to run his gloved hands along it until he found the wheel of the stopcock that controlled the flow of the steam into the line. Swiftly he spun the wheel, and the rushing sound of escaping steam rose sharply, then was snuffed out as the valve closed. It took ineffable pain to make a man like Jock McCrump sob, but he was crying like an infant as he staggered back to the foot of the companion ladder, then clambered painfully up to the deck. He stumbled out into the night air, which felt cold after the hellish atmosphere of the engine room, and Ryder caught him before he fell. He stared in horror at the huge blisters hanging from Jock's forearms. Then he roused himself and scooped more grease from the pot to cover them. But Rebecca had appeared suddenly and pushed him aside. This is woman's work, Mr. Courtney. You see to your boat and leave this to me. She was carrying a hurricane lamp, and by its feeble light examined Jock's arms, pursing her lips grimly. She set the lamp on the deck, crouched beside Jock, and began to work on his injuries. Her touch was deft and gentle. God love you, Jock McCrump, for what you've done to save my ship. Ryder lingered beside Jock. But the dervish are still shooting at us. As if to underline the fact, another Krupp's shell plunged into the river, so close alongside that the spray rained down on them like tropical cloudburst. How bad is the damage? Can we get power on at least one of the engines to get us out of range of the guns on the bank? I couldn't see much at all down there. But at the best odds, the main boiler will not have as much pressure in her as a virgin's fart. Jock glanced at Rebecca, begging your pardon, lassie. He stifled a groan as Rebecca touched one of the pendulous blisters, which burst open. I'm sorry, Mr. McCrump. Ugh, it's not at all. Dinna fash yourself, woman. Jock looked up at Ryder. Maybe, just maybe, I can knock together some kind of jury rig and get steam to the cylinders. It just depends on the damage she's suffered down there. But at the best, I doubt she'll get more than a few pounds of pressure into the line. Ryder straightened up and looked around. He saw the dark shape of Tooty Island, no more than a cable's length downstream from where they wallowed, powerless under the dervish guns. What the dervish cannon fire lacked in accuracy, it made up for in rapidity. From the sheer weight of shells being hurled at them, it could not be long before they received another direct hit. He watched the changing bearing of the island for a moment longer. The current is carrying us past the island. If we anchor on its lee, it will screen us from the guns. He left them and shoved his way through the passengers, shouting for Bakit and his mate Abu Sin. Clear the rabble out of the way and prepare to anchor at my command. They jumped to their stations, shoving and kicking aside the bewildered askari and stowaways to give themselves room to work. Bakshit freed the retaining tackle from the ring of the heavy fisherman's anchor that hung at her bows. Abu Sim stood over the chain where it emerged through the fair lead of the chain locker with the 4-pound hammer ready. Ryder peered back at the land, watching the muzzle flashes of the dervish guns and judging his moment. For a few minutes he held his breath while it seemed that they would be driven ashore on the island. Then an eddy in the current pushed them clear, and they drifted so close to the eastern side of the island that they were sheltered from the dervish batteries. "Let go!" Ryder shouted to Abu Sin, and with a blow of the sledgehammer he knocked the pin out of the anchor shackle. The anchor splashed into the river, the chain roaring out after it, and found the bottom. The chain stopped running, and Bakshit secured it. The Ibis came up hard and short, and spun round in the current to face upstream, with the timber barge behind her on her towline. The dervish cannon fire tapered off as the gunners found themselves deprived of their target. A few more shells screeched high overhead or burst ineffectually into the sandbanks of the screening island. Then the gunners gave up, and silence descended. Ryder found Jock sitting on the bunk in the cabin, being attended to by all the Benbrook ladies. "How are you feeling?" he asked solicitously. "Oh, not so bad, Skipper," he indicated his arms. "These bonny little lasses have done a fine job on them." Rebecca had bandaged both arms with strips that the twins had torn from one of the threadbare cotton bedsheets, then fashioned a double sling from the same material. Now she was brewing a mug of tea for him on the stove in the tiny galley next door. Jock grinned. "Home was never so good. That's why I ran away. Sorry to interrupt your retirement, but can I trouble you to take a peek at your engine?" "Just when I was really enjoying myself," Jock mumbled, but rose to his feet. "I'll bring your mug down to the engine room for you, Mr. McCrump," Amber promised. "And I'll bring one for you, Ryder," Saffron called. Jock McCrump followed Ryder down to the engine room. Bakshit and Abu Sin carried away the stoker's corpse, and by the light of a pair of hurricane lamps they assessed the damage. Now that Jock was able to examine his beloved engine more closely, he grumbled bitterly to disguise his relief.
"Bloody heathens! Can't trust them further than you can throw one of them. No sense of common decency doing this to me, Bonnie Cooper."
However, only the main steamline shot was through. The engine itself was untouched.
There's nut I can do for the steamline this side of me workshop in Khartoum. In the meantime, though, perhaps I can cobble something together to get a mite of steam through to the engine, but I reckon we'll not be breaking any speed records with the old girl."
Then he held up his bandaged arms.
"You'll have to do the donkey work, skipper."
Ryder nodded.
"While we're at it, I'm going to send Bakshit to move all our uninvited passengers across to the barge. That will correct my trim and give me a little more manoeuvrability and control. It will also give the crew more room to work the ship properly."
While the passengers were transshipped, Ryder and his engineer began the repairs. Working quickly but carefully, they bled off the remaining steam from the boilers and drew the fires from the grate. Then they used the inline valve cocks to isolate the damaged section of the main steamline. Once this was done, they could begin rigging a bypass line to carry steam through to the power plant. They had to measure the lengths they needed and cut the new pipe sections to length by hacksaw, then clamp them into the heavy vise on Jock's workbench and cut threads into the ends of the pipes with the hand dies. They packed the joints with asbestos thread and tightened the elbows and connectors with their combined weight on the long-handled pipe wrench. They ended up with a mare's nest of convoluted improvised piping. The work took the rest of the night, and by the time they were ready to test its integrity, dawn was showing through the engine room portholes. It took another hour to set the fires in the grates and work up a head of steam in the boiler. When the needle of the pressure gauge touched the green line, Jock gingerly eased open the cock of the steam valve. Ryder stood beside him and watched anxiously, hands black with grease, knuckles bruised and bleeding from rough contact with steel pipes. They held their breath as the needle on the secondary pressure gauge rose and watched the new pipe joints for the first sign of a leak.
"All holding," Jock grunted, and reached across to the port engine throttle. With a suck and a hiss of live steam, the big triple pistons began to pump up and down in their cylinders. The rods moved like the legs of marching men, and the propeller shaft rotated smoothly in its bearings. "Power up and holding," Jock grinned with the pride of accomplishment. "But I cannot take the chance and open her full. You'll have to take what you get, skipper, and thank the Lord and Jock McCrump for that much."
"You're a living, breathing miracle, Jock. I hope your mother was proud of you," Ryder chuckled. When he wiped the sweat off his forehead, the back of his fist left a black smear. "Now stand by to give me everything you can just as soon as I can get the anchor weighed and catted." He charged up the ladder to the bridge. Abu Sin followed him and ran to the controls of the steam winch. As the Ibis pushed slowly forward against the river current, the anchor chain came clanking in through the hawser hole. The flukes broke free from the riverbed and Ryder eased open the throttle. The Ibis responded so sluggishly that she made little headway against the 4-knot current. Ryder felt a cold slide of disappointment. He glanced over the stern at the barge. Drawing deeply under its cargo of cordwood and uninvited passengers, it was behaving with mulish recalcitrance. Dozens of pathetic faces stared across at him. "By God, I've half a mind to cut you free and leave you to the mercy of the Mahdi," he thought venomously. But with an effort, set the temptation aside. He turned instead to David, who had joined them silently. "She'll never be able to hold her own in the Shabluka Gorge. When the entire flow of the combined Niles is forced through the narrows, the current reaches almost 10 knots. With only half her power, the Ibis will be helpless in its grip. The risk of piling up on the rocky cliffs is too great to accept." "What other choice do you have?" "Nothing for it but to battle our way back to Khartoum." David looked worried. "My girls. I hate to take them back to that death trap. How long will Gordon be able to hold out in the city before the dervishes break in?" "Let's hope it's long enough for Jock to finish his repairs so that we can make another run for it. But now our only hope is to get back into the harbour." Ryder turned the Ibis across the current and headed her for the east bank. He tried to keep the bulk of Tuti Island between the ship and the Dervish batteries, but before they were halfway across, the first shells were howling above the river. However, with the current giving him some assistance, Ryder opened the range swiftly, and the skill of the Bedlam Bedouin and his comrades was not up to the task of hitting a target as small as the intrepid Ibis at a range of over a mile, except by the direct intervention of Allah. This day, however, their prayers went unanswered, and although there were a few encouraging near misses, the Ibis and her barge made good their crossing of the main stream, then turned south for the city, hugging the furthest edge of the channel at extreme range for the crops. The Dervish feluccas sallied out from the west bank and made another attempt to intercept the steamer. But by now the sun was high. General Gordon's artillery on the riverfront of Khartoum was able to direct furious and remarkably accurate fire upon the enemy flotilla as it came within easy range. Ryder saw four small boats blown into splinters by direct hits with high explosive and correctly fused shells. The severed limbs and heads of the crews were hurled high into the yellow clouds of lyddite fumes. This discouraged all but a few of the bravest, most foolhardy captains, and most of the small boats turned back for the shore. Three of the attack boats pressed on across the river, but the wind blew strongly from the south, and the current was at 5 knots from the same direction. Two of the feluccas were swept downstream and were unable to make good a course to intercept the Ibis. Only one of them stood in her way, but Ryder had been given plenty of time to prepare a reception for it. He ordered all the deck passengers to lie flat, so as to offer no target to the attackers. As the enemy vessel raced towards them, heeled over by the wind and pushed along by the current, Bakshit and Abu Sin were crouched below the starboard bulwark. "Let them get close," Ryder called down from the bridge as he judged the moment. Then he raised his voice to full pitch. "Now!" he bellowed. Bakshit and Abu Sin sprang up from hiding and aimed the brass nozzles of the steam hoses down into the undecked hull of the felucca. They opened the valves, and solid white jets of live steam from the Ibis's boiler engulfed the warriors crowded into the open boat. Their bloodthirsty war cries and angry challenges turned into screams of anguish as the dense clouds of steam flayed the skin and flesh from their faces and bodies. The hull of the felucca crashed heavily against the steel of the Ibis's hull, and the impact snapped off the mast at deck level. The felucca scraped down the steel side of the steamer, then spun out of control in her wake. She now wallowed directly in the path of the heavily laden barge. The Ansar were so blinded by the steam that they did not see her coming. The barge smashed into the frail craft and trod her under the surface. None of her crew surfaced again. "That takes care of that," Ryder murmured with satisfaction, then forced a smile at Rebecca. "Forgive me for depriving you of the comfort of the cabin floor, but tonight you will have to make do with your own bed in the palace." "That is a hardship I am determined to endure with the utmost stoicism, Mr. Courtney." Her smile was almost as unconvincing as his, but he was amazed at how pretty she looked in the midst of so much mayhem and ugliness.